Which college should we hope that all of our elected officials have to go through before taking office? Today on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our Vice Chairman and our Technical Guru, Chuck Michaelis.
And I am a college graduate, but I'm not a graduate of that particular college.
That's right. Okay, what college are we talking about? Harvard? Yale? Princeton? Maybe the Ohio State University? None of the above. The college we're talking about was actually founded before the last one and probably post the other three, but it was one founded by our founders. It was the Electoral College. And I'm really going to just basically sit back and turn the mic over to a man who knows more about the Electoral College than about anybody, more than about three people on the face of the planet, and that's our Vice Chairman, Chuck Michaelis. Chuck, please help us out to figure out why we need to send our elected officials to this college.
Well, of course, the only elected officials that would actually go through the college, hopefully, if it works the way it's supposed to, is the executive branch, because that is who is elected by the Electoral College.
All right.
Now, we would ask the three questions. What was the original intent of the Electoral College? How has it changed? And does it still work? Now, as for the original intent, of course, always was to elect a chief executive of the United States of America. However, a lot of people have kind of the wrong idea of how that was all supposed to work. They assume that it was always a popular election and that people were always angry about this bunch who gets in the way of the popular vote in the form of the Electoral College. And that is the fault of the educational system, because nobody teaches the Electoral College. That all they do is sit around and debate it and talk about how it's outdated. And in fact, it is not outdated. It works exactly still, even though it is somewhat broken from the original intent. It still does work.
Well, why did our founders decide that this type of a structure was necessary at all? I mean, wasn't it enough just to say the whole country loves George Washington, and so therefore we're going to make him president?
You know, and a lot of people don't understand that in the first election where George Washington was chosen, nobody voted except the Electoral College.
And now, folks, that's a piece of historical trivia that you ought to keep for parties.
Yeah, what basically happened was the states appointed electors who then unanimously voted for George Washington. And I believe also voted in such a way that John Adams was I think he was the only vice presidential candidate in that particular election. And they were votes number one and two, the way the original setup was done on the Constitution. The person who got the first number of votes that was a majority, in other words, 50% plus one, was the president, and the person who came in second place, no matter what, obviously they couldn't have a majority, they had to have a minority. The person who got the second number of votes was the vice president.
Why did they structure it that way? I mean, why wouldn't it have been, because we've heard today in this modern era that, well, the Electoral College is outdated and outmoded, and we need to go with the winner of the popular vote. Now, when we're talking about president, we're hearkening back, obviously, to 2000 and hanging chads and U.S. Supreme Court weighing in on it, and we're dealing with situations like the Bush-Gore election. Why did our founders not think that that was a good idea?
Well, the founders were, first of all, very righteously lived in fear of direct democracy. And the idea, remember, of the presidency and, in fact, the entire federal government was that most individual citizens were not supposed to ever really have much contact with the federal government. In fact, up until about 1861 or so, the only contact most people ever had with the federal government was when they went to the post office to pick up mail.
And I'm sure a lot of our listeners today would like to go back and harken back to those days when the only contact you really had with the federal government was picking up your mail.
Well, as the owner of a heavily regulated business, I would say that there are some very arbitrary decisions that come in when federal power is usurped from state governments, and that's exactly what's happened in the case of my business. We won't go into that. but the fact is that the president was supposed to be simply the executive head of a government for governments. In other words, the president was supposed to be the person who was in charge of executing the federal laws that had something to do with three different things, the only powers that the federal government has, and that's over what we call, kind of jokingly here,
DDT.
DDT. We call it the DDT program.
Defense. We're not talking about pesticides.
That's right. It's not
gentlemen.
Pesticides. So we're not talking about the EPA here. It's DDT is defense, diplomacy, and trade. So that's why the president has treaty making power, because of his diplomacy job. Also why the president is commander in chief with his defense job. And the trade issue, again, that's usually done by treaty, and again, that's in the hands of the president and the Senate. The other issues are the taxes to run the whole mess, and that's in the hands of the House of Representatives. So, really, the president's job was supposed to be this executive head of a government of governments, and really, people had no reason to want to directly vote for the president. And that's why you don't see much squawking over the fact that only in a few states, for the first 40 years or so, was there direct election of members of the Electoral College. Now, we're really putting this in shorthand, but the fact is that the number of states that allowed popular vote for the election of electors was very small up until about 1828, when things just got turned right up on their head. I admire Andrew Jackson for a number of things, but for what he did to the political system, I'm not an admirer. He was great on the National Bank. He was terrible on what he did, because Andrew Jackson really truly is the father of political parties.
Now, kind of spinning forward a little bit, because you said something there just a moment ago that I think we need to make sure that the listeners understand. Nobody actually votes for the president directly.
That's absolutely correct.
Not in this country. Even though when we go to the we're having all these debates right now, and you're seeing all the candidates trot out, and they're telling you what they believe, what they don't believe, what they stand for, what they stand against. And we all think that when we walk to the polls, or drive to the polls, or perambulate somehow to the polls, that what we're doing when we go into the ballot box is we're picking our guy. Really, depending where which state you're in, you're picking a large group of men and women both to sit in the Electoral College.
That's correct. And the fact is that a lot of people just don't quite grasp that. And part of the reason they don't grasp it is the way, we're going to jump way ahead here, and I want to save this for a little later, but the fact is people don't get it because of the way we award Electoral College votes.
Yeah, let's hold on that until a little bit later in the program. But, ladies and gentlemen, just to look at it, when a candidate for president specifically files to be a candidate in your state, whether it's here in Ohio or whether it's in other states, they file a nominating petition. But if you've ever seen a presidential nominating petition, and Mr. Michaels and I both have seen one.
In fact, you have you've been on one. If I
I've been on as an elector for a presidential candidate. Yes,
and
I have
been an alternate.
Okay. But when they fill that form out, they have to list the names of people in each of the states' congressional districts, and then two other people, which would be the two electors for the U.S. senators in each state, because each state gets an elector for each one of the state senators, and then an elector for each congressional district there is in the state. So in Ohio in 2008, there was a slate of 20 electors that each presidential candidate had on their nominating petitions. And so when they went around and collected signatures to get on the ballot, what they were actually putting on the ballot not only was their name on the ballot line, but the listing of the people who, should they win the office, would be the ones who would go to the state capitol.
That's right.
That's usually at state capitals, to then go cast their votes for that person for the office of president. Because, as we all know, every election, so every presidential election cycle, every 4 years, everybody stays up really late watching TV, Why? Because we're doing a count. It's not like the New Year's Eve countdown to zero to midnight. We're counting up to a certain number, a number of electoral votes that a candidate has to receive in order to win the presidency.
That's correct. There are currently 538 total electoral votes. And that comes from all the congressional districts, plus two senators from each state, plus three from the District of Columbia. And that particular abomination is the result of a really bad constitutional amendment that really needs to be repealed. But again, another show. And that number comes to 538. And a majority of those is 270. So the first person to hit 270 electoral votes is the president of the United States. Now, that is if he heads the ticket. In the old days, the way it worked, the original intent was that the first five vote getters,
the top five,
if one person out of those five did not get 50% plus one of the votes, then it would automatically go to the House of Representatives, the top five vote getters. Now, here's a little understood fact under that system, real quick, because this is a time eater. I'll ask you, and I actually, when I gave this presentation at Camp American 3 years ago, you also answered this question. Let's see if you remember what your answer was, because you were wrong the first time.
And I'll probably be wrong again. This is not an area of my strength.
I have it on film. What is the minimum number if each person, each delegation was allowed to vote for one person from their state and one person not from their state? That was the original electoral ballot. You got to vote for one person from your state and one person not from your state. That doesn't mean you were required to vote for somebody. What's the minimum number of candidates that would be on the presidential, the number of presidential candidates that would be under consideration?
Are you looking at it in that original framework?
Yes, the original framework.
So original with 13 colonies, there would have to be 13 candidates at minimum because
you have
to vote for one for each of your
You got it wrong the first time, but you got it right this time.
Well, that's because I'm now awake. It's the middle of the afternoon, and it's not early morning after a late night campfire at camp.
That's right. Okay, there would have been 13 candidates. And the way they looked at this was, chances were, this is a consideration you really have to keep in mind. When the framers founded the Electoral College, they didn't actually expect it to elect a president.
Then why did they found it?
Okay, they founded it as basically a search committee.
Okay. You're going to have to unpack that one for the listeners, I think, just a little bit.
What they really were assuming was everyone would vote for president with someone from their state.
So, in other words, they would be homers. They'd be localers.
That's
it. And they'd say, hey, this guy's going to bring home the bacon for our state, and so therefore he's getting my vote.
If you understand the way people thought about their states in the 18th century, the fact is that was their country.
Exactly, because they were all each sovereign entities.
They had a sovereignty. Okay. That being said, they assumed that everyone would vote for someone from their state and someone who was a regional favorite.
So, in other words, if you were a Virginian delegate, you'd probably vote for, say, old George Washington from your state, and then you'd look around and say, oh, well, there's an Adams guy from Massachusetts. Let's vote for him.
Well, chances are, when you say regional, chances are it would be someone from Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina.
Exactly, split a little on different
lines there. Yeah, maybe you might get somebody from Maryland as a compromise candidate or, you know, Delaware perhaps. But the fact is what they expected to come out of that was as many as 13 candidates, maybe as few as five. And none of those would gain a clear victory, so it would then go to the House of Representatives, where a president would be chosen from those five.
Well, let me ask you a question, because I'm sure that it's crossed the minds of some of our listeners in this. Wouldn't that system skew toward the larger states who had more representation? Because if you think about it, states like New York, Virginia, maybe even Massachusetts – would have large, and obviously Pennsylvania would have large bodies of delegates, and if they decided to become collusive and say, New York and Pennsylvania decided, well, I'll tell you what, we're all going to vote for the guy from Pennsylvania for president and then for the guy from New York for vice president. And let's say that just by happenstance that of the other 11 colonies, it split fairly evenly that half the delegates in each of the other colonies voted for one of those two men from those two other states for the other slot.
Here's why that's a great question, and here's why the design is so genius.
That's what I wanted to get to, because it's starting to seem to me like maybe there's a flaw here.
Once you get to the House of Representatives, every state gets only one vote.
That's it right there.
They have to vote by delegation.
Okay, so you can't have any guys going off the reservation once it goes to the House.
That's right.
And so even beforehand, so when you've got that slate, say even as high as that 13 candidates, that the mathematical probabilities of any one candidate getting 50% plus one of the total electoral votes in all 13 colonies is pretty limited.
Well, let's put it this way. That was the thinking at the time.
Okay.
However,
I knew there had to be some wrinkle in history.
In practice, it turns out that the only time that in history that the top three vote-getters all had to go, that there were actually three.
Okay.
So remember, the idea of, quote-unquote, a two-party system from the founding of the country is simply laughable.
Well, the point is that we didn't have parties at the founding of the country.
That's right.
We'll discuss that a little bit more later.
And, in fact, the system is designed to negate. The original system is designed to keep faction, what they called party faction, out of elections. Okay, so we've got this system where each state gets one vote. Now they have to get in there and decide who the best candidate out of those five. The search committee of the Electoral College has narrowed it to five candidates. Mm-hmm. Who's the best guy for the job, you know, of those five?
But don't we still also – now, by that time when it gets to the House –
Oh, you know what? I forgot. The only time it ever worked was 1824.
Okay.
Top three vote-getters, and remember, by this time it's been altered by the 12th Amendment so that the top three are only go to the House of Representatives.
So, in other words, we've limited it now to three that can go after the 12th Amendment.
And we've had other changes that allow party faction to move in, such as instead of voting, each elector voting for one person, probably from their state, not necessarily, and another person for president, you now voted for two people. One person specifically for president, one person specifically for vice president.
Was that the idea of running on a slate?
That was the slate idea.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that being said, it went to the House of Representatives, the top three, and the top three were John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, and a guy named William Crawford, who was the Secretary of State.
This is 1824. Okay.
And basically what happened was there was some, you know, they went to the House of Representatives, and Henry Clay was actually the Speaker of the House. He was one of the candidates who was number four.
Ah.
So what
happened? Little sour grapes there.
Possibly. And the House of Representatives decided that essentially that John Q. Adams would be a better president than Andrew Jackson, even though Andrew Jackson won the popular vote.
Ah, so in other words, what happened in 2000 with Bush-Gore isn't the first time in history where we've had one candidate win the popular vote, but another candidate, because of the Electoral College, be declared the President of the United States.
We have three that I can think of.
Okay, very good. But let's go back. Before we get into that, let's go back around here. So now we've got it into the House of Representatives, whether it was 13,
right.
5, or 3 now.
Yeah.
Each delegation, each state's delegation, regardless of how many congressmen and the two U.S. senators, each delegation gets one vote.
One vote.
And it was for one individual, and so the top vote getter who gets, is it 50% plus one of that?
50% plus one.
So in other words, that vote could have gone through the House a number of times until they got down to one candidate.
Okay.
Do they do a single elimination type thing where the bottom vote getter gets thrown off and they revote it?
In the election of 1800,
okay,
there were 26 ballots in the House of Representatives to elect Thomas Jefferson.
26 ballots in 1800. Now, they didn't have this trouble with George Washington in his first term because he was unanimously elected.
Twice.
Twice by the college, not by popular vote.
John Adams, however, was not elected vice president unanimously twice.
That's right. He was not.
He was number one. He got a majority out of 13 candidates.
So you see, it did work, and it worked well with George Washington and then John Adams. And then we have an 1800.
A tie vote Aaron Burr
mm-hmm.
and Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson. And it goes to the House.
And that...
26 ballots later. Nobody
can
get close. If you think about it, if there are only 13 states, colonies, whatever you want to call them at this point, if there's only 13, 50% plus one means you have to get seven.
That's right.
You had to get seven of those delegations to say, okay, yeah, we can support this guy.
In 1800, I think there were 15 states.
15. So in other words, we're looking at eight.
Eight.
So even... took 26 ballots to get to 8 votes for president.
And that's because the opposite party was in control of the House of Representatives when the vote was taken, and they did not want to relinquish power. Both John Adams and George Washington had been Federalists,
mm-hmm.
and Thomas Jefferson was a Republican. Aaron Burr was also a Republican. He was supposed to be, the scheme was, remember, this is before party politics, and this is before you voted for a separate president and vice president.
But we're still using the term scheme in yes. regard to politics.
It is a scheme because it is a party-related deal. Someone was supposed to not vote for Aaron Burr.
On one of the ballots,
and he forgot or got cantankerous.
Or somebody got to him, or things that can happen.
So we ended up with a tie vote between Burr and Jefferson.
Okay, well, let's fast forward. I mean, that's great history, and I think maybe hopefully people are starting to get this.
Yeah.
But let's fast forward. Let's go to today's Electoral College.
Okay.
We know that a presidential candidate has to receive... running nationwide in all 50 states, has to come up to a total of 270 Electoral College votes.
That's correct.
All right. Let's say we're after the election. The first Tuesday and after the first Monday in November is all over with in that even-numbered year every 4 years. The dust is starting to settle. We say Joe Smith has been voted president because he's gotten 272 mm-hmm. out of the 538 electoral votes. Well, then the Electoral College is called to meet, I think, sometime in December.
Right.
What – now, his slate of electors – obviously, one of the things that we have, a nuance that we have that's different than sounds somewhat different than what we had during the original formation our founders had for the Electoral College is now, I know, in Ohio and in other states, we are what's called a winner-take-all state. In other words, whoever wins the popular vote or is the head of the popular vote – in the state gets all the delegates.
We're one of 48 states. There are 48 states that have the so-called winner-take-all system, and that
is... So there are still two that still do it the old way.
There are still two. Maine and Nebraska still do it the way it was originally designed, and that is that the original design was for delegates to be awarded on the basis of congressional district.
So in other words, whichever way a certain congressional district would trend or vote... Let's say here in Ohio, the first congressional district would vote for Joe Smith, but districts 2 through 7 voted for Jane Doe, and then districts 8 through 16, because we now only have 16 congressional districts in this next election,
right?
Based on our new math, voted for Joe. So in other words, he'd get nine. Joe would get 9,
yep.
And 7 would go to Jane.
Mm-hmm.
But in Ohio now, and that's under the original plan,
and that's the plan in Nebraska and Maine.
Okay, and that's the plan currently in Nebraska and Maine. But now, because Jane won those 7 congressional districts in the big cities, Jane wins all 18 of the votes because you get the 2 senatorial votes along with it, right?
You get the 2 senatorial votes based on – hang on. Those two senatorial votes go to the winner of the popular election, or the overall numbers.
Okay, so Jane, who's only won 7 of the congressional district toss-ups for the Electoral College, so those 7 votes. Now, I'm talking about the original way the original system would operate today in Ohio. So Jane wins 7 congressional districts. Joe wins 9.
Mm-hmm.
So by 50% plus one math, Joe would be actually the winner of the state, But because Jane won her districts in heavily populated, let's say Joe won it out in Van Wert and down in Athens and out somewhere in Salina and Bucyrus and Kenton and those areas.
Yeah.
But Jane won Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, Dayton, Youngstown, etc. Right. Jane, in our system today, wins all 18 votes.
That's it.
She gets them all assigned to her because she won the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you broke that map down, and people, you know, you've seen maps even after the 2000 election because we're talking red state, blue state. You ever looked at those maps where it breaks it down by congressional district and which way each congressional district trended? It's an entirely different picture.
Yes.
And if we did it by congressional districts, we would have never had the argument in 2000 about hanging chads.
Well, that's right. And part of the argument in 2000 was some funky math that somebody wanted to do with, representative. They wanted to do representative counts and that kind of thing.
The purple math. Yes.
It was statistical nightmare, basically. It was white lies, black lies, and statistics, and they wanted to do statistics. But the way it works in Nebraska and in Maine is that. For each one of those congressional districts where you win the vote, you win that electoral college vote as well, and that's why on election night, Nebraska and Maine are always the last ones to report because you got to count every vote.
So every vote does count in the original structure that we had with the electoral college.
You betcha. You got and what it also does is if you think about this. Joe, who got maybe 48% of the popular vote, gets 0% of the electoral vote.
Well, that's true.
And why are those people disenfranchised?
Oh, but see, we can't use that D word because people might starting to think.
That's right.
But, you and I have had this discussion before, and we've discussed it with other people. And the whole idea is that we want to try to find out whether or not our founders' formula would be sufficient for today. But I think as we're talking here, we're starting to see that all the changes that we've made to be more progressive and to be more with the times and to bring people in to vote really are disenfranchising more and more people because your vote, let's just take Ohio. Let's say that we got a lot of people who've been living in the big cities, but they're tired of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And they decide they want to move somewhere where things are a little bit more conservative. They move out to the Van Werts and the Kentons and the Salinas and the Gallipolises and those places of the world. And then they go to cast their votes. Well, even let's say that represents 49.9%.
That's right.
Of the vote. It's still that if another candidate who takes the three C's and the big eights and gets 50.1% of the vote, they get all those electoral votes.
Here's something that the reason that the major parties hate the idea of going to congressional district election of electoral college electors. Think about this. Once you go to an electoral to a congressional district style election, you only have to win a third party candidate only has to win his congressional district. He doesn't have to win the whole state to get one vote. He has to win one congressional district.
But wait a minute. Wouldn't that be chaos and we'd be back to where no candidate could get 270 electoral votes if we did it that way?
And we've already proven in several elections that letting the House of Representatives choose from the top vote getters is a viable system.
Now, in that system as well, that would still hold that even though we have 50 states and a District of Columbia, there'd be 51 votes that would be possible, and so somebody would have to get 26.
Yes.
So in other words, that candidate would have to basically either show well in at least 26 of the 50 states or be able to put a coalition together to convince the congressional delegation. And that includes the House and the Senate, because they'd have to come. So Ohio's 16 House members, whether they're in their R's and D's, and the Senate would have to go and sit down and figure out, okay, who are we going to cast a vote for?
That's right. They'd have to get together and caucus as a state.
So in other words, not as a party,
no.
As a state. So in other words, they'd have to put aside the party designations to cast as a state. And let's say that in, well, let's say in those states you had a situation where, well, first of all, I can see where this is going to open it up to more than just the Republicans and the Democrats. There are going to be a lot of third party and independent candidates who can win, say, 10, 15 congressional districts across the country because, you know, they those trend more.
Sure.
I mean, New Hampshire, for one thing, with trends much more libertarian.
Well, you've got a senator up there, Bernie Sanders, who they always indicate as independent,
yes.
But in fact, he's S for socialist.
He's a socialist, which means he's fitting in well with the current administration.
Well, yeah.
But that being beside the point, the whole point is that the delegation would have to come together, and they'd have to start looking at what's in the best interest of the state.
And that's
exactly
right.
Not what's in the best interest of the party.
And what it would do is require – now, sure, in Ohio, the Ohio congressional delegation could steamroll the Democrats and say, we're going Republican no matter what you say. But that sort of creates a tit-for-tat situation, and when the tables are turned, it gets you the same thing. Now, what – you know, I'm no Pollyanna and know that some bad things can happen in a caucus. But you'd want some support from some of your more conservative Democrats. So who would, you know?
Well, let's say that your state comes back out with its one vote and it casts it for Joe Smith. And then at the end of the day, Joe Smith doesn't have 26 votes. He's only got 22 and Jane's got 18 and you know, and I'll keep and somebody else has got 10. Uh-oh, we got another revote. We got to go back in and caucus again.
That's right. That's why it took 26 ballots to get Thomas Jefferson elected.
And I'm sure by the end of the day, those delegations, and because, you know, back then, you know, a state was somewhat more homogenous in relation to its politics. You know, Federalists kind of trended together in a state.
Right.
Anti-Federalists or the Republicans trended together in certain states.
Federalists were the Northeast. The Republicans were the South, the mid South states.
Well, we don't really have that so much in the United States now. So, in other words, this could go on for a little while. They'd still be under the same deadlines. They'd have to certify it by a certain day.
Well, it took a week to get Jefferson elected. I think it was seven full days or so.
Now, would it be better or worse? Because you can imagine, and I know the cynics out there that are listening to this are going to say, well, hey, you're just going to, you know, the guy with the most money can go and flash money to these congressional delegations and buy his way into the presidency. What's to stop that?
Well, the fact is, first of all, you've already narrowed your field down to a maximum of three candidates.
That's true.
You've already hopefully chosen someone who isn't thinking in that direction. You can't just go in. In fact, this is part of that election of 1800 thing with Jefferson. At one point, the rules are very clear in the Constitution. You have to pick from the candidates that you got from the Electoral College.
Wait.
But they talked about actually electing someone who was completely off the slate. In other words, completely violating the Constitution, and that created some rancorous feelings amongst the population who understood the system.
Yeah, so in other words, these congressional delegations would be putting themselves in jeopardy by trying to go outside the will of the voters.
That's right.
Now, the one thought that did occur to me, though, is if a candidate, let's say it's whether it's Barack Obama or it's a Mitt Romney or John Huntsman, all the billionaires club, well, let's say even if they are the three who at the end of the day are going to the House of Representatives, if you have to run in each congressional district in order to win it, how much money are they going to have to spend to get there? And if they don't make that 50% plus one of the electoral before getting to the House of Reps, how much money are they going to have left to do influence?
That's an excellent point, because it's a lot harder to buy 270 electoral congressional districts than it is to buy airtime and by the election in Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, Dayton, and maybe Youngstown or Akron, Canton, or one of the other population centers, it would be a lot more expensive. So buying elections is basically out.
Well, there'd still be attempts to do it.
Oh, of course.
You know, we're not Pollyanna-ish
here at the
Institute for Principal Policy, and we know money plays a huge role in elections, and graft and corruption play huge roles in elections. But the point is that in order, the reason why we have all the money, the graft, and corruption now is because we got away from what the founders intended in the first place.
And that's right. And also, we have allowed the population centers to become also the political power centers. And the reason for that partly has to do with the way, I mean, it's an outgrowth of how we think about our government in general. In 1787, when this thing was all set up and completed and gotten ready for ratification, the essentially the basis that everybody thought on, their worldview,
yes,
was for liberty. In 2011,
we seem to be coming back around to that.
Well, hopefully. But in 2011, we think in terms of democracy.
And there's the devil's in the detail.
That's right.
Because our founders, and most people know this quote one way or the other, because you hear it a lot, that, you know, after the formation of the Constitution, when they walked out, supposedly the old adage is that a woman comes up to Benjamin Franklin on the steps,
right,
of Independence Hall and says, "Well, what kind of a government have you given us, Dr. Franklin?" And his response was, supposedly back to her, "A republic.
Madam,
if you can keep it.
A republic, madam, if you can keep it.
If you can keep it." Yes, he was very much a gentleman.
Yes.
But the whole point is that they didn't develop a democracy. As a matter of fact, I think James Madison had some pointed words about a democracy, didn't he?
Well, let's talk about that in electoral terms. What percentage of the federal government was actually popularly elected in the early part of the republic, before 1913?
Wow, that's a good question. I'm not even sure I know.
Okay. One-third.
Okay.
Actually, no, take it back. One-sixth.
One-sixth.
Okay.
And how did that
now
work
let
out?
Me run the math down for you.
Okay.
Okay, you've got a House of Representatives that consists of two houses.
A House that consists of two houses or a Congress?
Congress that consists of two houses.
The House of Representatives
and the Senate. The Senate was chosen by...
The
choice of the states.
The state legislatures.
The state legislatures. Okay, no popular election there.
Right, they were appointed.
The House of Representatives was chosen by Democratic vote.
Okay.
By congressional district, not by the state. You didn't hand out congressional votes by the whole vote of the state. You handed them out district by district.
And we still do that today.
Right. The president was not elected popularly. He was elected by a representative system.
Wherein,
okay, and the Supreme Court and all the other minor courts under the sub courts underneath that are set up by Congress
are appointed.
Those are appointed and are not democratically elected. Now,
right,
we're not talking numerically here, but we're talking by branch. Only 1/6 of the federal government was popularly elected,
and that makes sense. And again, this is under the original structure when we didn't have the popular direct election of senators. And even though we still have an electoral college, we have groups out there right now who are calling for national popular vote. I mean, we've heard it. We've heard it from both sides. That do you want to do away with this outdated, outmoded electoral college because we want the people to decide the presidency?
Right. Well, let's continue on this popular vote thing just for a second. Now, after 1913, what happened? We changed over from giving the states representation in the federal government, the state government's representation in the federal government through the Senate, to a popularly elected Senate.
That would be the 17th Amendment.
That would be number 17. Now, what did that do? Suddenly we went from 1/6 to 1/3. So we didn't really change it that much. We went to 1/3 of the federal government is popularly elected.
Uh-huh.
The president still, believe it or not, even though people think so, he is not popularly elected. He is elected by an electoral college.
Right, and you're voting for the slate of electors when you go cast a vote for Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich or whomever it might be. You're actually yes, you personally are voting for that person, but technically, legally, you're voting for a bunch of people behind
That's right.
them that'll go cast a vote for them when it comes time to call the electoral college.
Now, when you think about it, basically 48 states have adopted an unfair system for rewarding presidential electors.
Oh. I can hear the howls and screams now, Chuck. No, you're going to disenfranchise. Well, no, folks, that's the whole point.
That's right.
When we take it away from the system our founders intended, we are disenfranchising people. When a state like Ohio, who may have voted 51% for one candidate and 49% of the other, has to cast all their votes
100%.
That are representative of the electors in the entire state for that one candidate, you've just disenfranchised that 49%. They have no say, and we did it because of efficiency's sake.
I'm not even sure it was efficiency's sake. I think it was partisan party politics' sake, because a lot of states still awarded electors on that basis up until, about the end of the 19th century or so, and then we started switching over very quickly. For instance, South Carolina still awarded presidential electors by choice of the state government until 1861.
Okay. So there were a number of structures, but what we're talking about here is going back to the original structure that our founders intended in the document. Now, okay, we've been talking all this time about the technical aspects of it, but the one thing we haven't talked about is, where do you find this in the Constitution?
Okay. Presidential election goodies are always in Article 2, and it has to do, the reason for that is that's the section that deals with the executive branch office. Now, what you will find when you read Article 2, if you have the right kind of, if you have a little thing, some of these are marked that to show you that a lot of Article 2 has been amended, and it's been amended by the 12th Amendment. It's been amended by the 20th, strictly speaking, the electoral process has been altered by the 12th, the 20th, the 22nd, the 23rd, the 24th, and the 25th amendments.
So in other words, for a long time, there's been an attempt to nationally popularize the Electoral College.
Yeah, and some of the changes weren't horrible, but some of them were downright just awful. For instance, giving District of Columbia state status essentially by awarding them three, what they would normally get if they were a small state, one congressional district equivalent and two senatorial equivalents. And
really equivalents what, because they don't have the votes in Congress, but they do count for electoral college.
That's right. What should have been done was that population should have been counted as part of the seating state, which is Maryland, for purposes of representation and in the electoral college.
But the reason why it wasn't originally was because it was silent in the Constitution.
Well, because of Article 1, which basically says that in a district 10 miles square, the federal government shall have full authority. They don't have no state has authority over that district. Now, what's interesting about that is the original 10-mile square, Virginia got mad in the 1840s and took their part back. So the only part that's left of D.C. is in the Maryland section, and that's been completely ceded to the federal government.
Okay.
So that being said, things have changed drastically, but Article 2 is really where the meat is. And okay. It is long and complex, and I won't kid you about that, but it's really not that hard to discern if you sit down with a piece of paper and you kind of graph it out, which is what I did the first time. Now I don't need to do that anymore, thank goodness, about the original plan. What's really great about the original plan is as it looks complex, but as simple as it is for what it was they were trying to do, and that was they were trying to make sure that the states were happy, that the faction was reduced, that basically they were doing things like, give the state governments a strong voice in the choice, desire the small states to avoid being overwhelmed by the large states.
Ah, a problem that we discussed a little bit earlier.
That's
about how this whole structure started.
Right. And a desire to keep single states from dominating the executive branch.
Ah, see, now that makes a lot of sense. Seems like our founders were onto something because they understood the basic nature of man, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
And ladies and gentlemen, for those of you out there, the basic nature of man is not good. You know, if you look at Scripture, it says the heart is deceitful and desperately evil. Who can know it? And if you look, that there's situations where people just did evil continually. See, that was the biblical worldview of our founders. They understood the biblical view of man in his natural state, and part of the reason why they've structured this document in such a way to provide for those checks and balances in between the branches and even how we get people in the branches was because they had an appreciation for the truth of God's word.
And the founders understood the interstate rivalries very well. For instance, Virginia did dominate. I mean, how many presidents were born? I think a grand total of 8. Ohio and Virginia are tied for the number of presidents that they've provided. And then there are a couple of states that are starting to catch up rather rapidly. But the fact is they didn't want Virginia to be able to completely dominate, and that's why the Electoral College was set up the way it was. So, again, this whole idea of not allowing population centers to overwhelm the rural countryside and not allowing large states to overwhelm the small states.
Which now, with winner take all in these states, the large municipalities have a disparate advantage over rural areas.
Oh, and that's right. Now, we've heard some complaints on for instance, that this is a bad system because congressional districts can be gerrymandered inside of a state to create major advantages for certain parties and that kind of thing, and that they can gerrymander to the point where they'll dominate politics for, you know, until the next census and that kind of thing. And honestly, I think that's an errant notion because, first of all, political loyalties and trends change much more rapidly than the 10 years between reapportionments. And honestly, I don't think, at least in Ohio, I don't know about other states, and I'm pretty sure it's the same way, you can't gerrymander to the point where there are laws in place that require congressional districts to have certain kinds of makeups.
Yeah, there are certain federally required standards that have to be taken into consideration in the crafting of these districts. Now, you know, or anybody who's seen, you know, right now Ohio's going through that reapportionment
right.
process. So anybody who's seen the new congressional maps would probably say, hey, you guys are crazy. Look at these districts, especially that one here that looks like a big backward C, upside down C with the little, little mark on the top of it. Yeah, well, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, though, one of the things that they try to deal with is keeping communities of interest together, which means you're going to see more consolidation in large urban areas than you're going to see out in rural areas, because a community of interest in a rural area may spread over 22 counties.
Well, let's talk about proof of concept for a minute, because in 2008, Barack Obama got, what, something like 52% of the vote in Ohio, something like that?
My history's a little fuzzy on that, but yes.
But we didn't, the Republicans ended up with a majority of the House districts in Ohio.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So what does that say? Well, what that says is that not everybody pulled a straight party ticket. So,
well, that much is clear, and that's going on historically.
That's
people
right.
People don't vote straight party tickets as much anymore as they used to.
Yeah, and I'm not sure they ever really did. It depends, but the fact is, maybe earlier in the Republic, actually, party feeling was stronger than in many cases it is now. There are an awful lot of independents out there, but the fact is that negates the idea that you can gerrymander a district to collect Electoral College election votes, because many people are not voting straight party tickets. That negates the argument of the gerrymandered district. You're not necessarily going to win the district presidentially that you win congressionally.
Mm-hmm.
And that proof of concept is there in those numbers from 2008.
That's absolutely correct. You know, again, it's a situation where if you take a look at Ohio, I mean, yeah, you're right, in 08, because in 2000, you know, lines were drawn by the control of a certain, the majority control of a certain party. But before the end of the decade, party control had flipped, at least in one of the chambers, and had flipped fully at the statewide level, with the exception of one seat. So you don't have the whole idea of gerrymandering. I mean, that's yes. Does it? Do they try to do that? Of course they try to do that.
Of course they do.
Does it work out perfectly? Well, of course not. Is it bound by certain laws that they must take into consideration, so therefore they can't just do it willy-nilly? Absolutely. Does it really have any impact on the presidential electoral college, which is what we're talking about? The only impact it has is that it's not, they don't award the electoral votes in a state by the congressional district.
That's right. By the congressional vote.
By the congressional vote in the district.
It's awarded by the presidential vote inside the congressional district.
Right. So that would be the way it would be done. So therefore, if you're going to be drawing congressional districts, it'd be like, well, we'd have to have a crystal ball to figure out who's going to be the nominee of each party for the president.
Over the next 10 years.
Over the next 10 years. So at least two, if not three cycles worth of having prescient understanding of who the nominees are going to be, so that you know how people are going to react in each congressional district to whether or not they like Joe Smith or Jane Doe.
That's right. Now, there's another consideration here, and that is one of the things that they wanted to do was also quell regionalism. And by that, I mean the idea of the South against the middle, mid-Atlantic states against the northeastern states, you know, the New England states against the western, what they called the western states at the time, which was, for instance, in the early Republic, Kentucky. Pennsylvania was actually considered a western state at one point, you know, when even Horace Greeley, when he said, go west, young man, meant go to Ohio. So one of those things, and we see a clear example of it, for instance, in the election of 1888. And this is one of those ones where the candidate was Grover Cleveland versus Benjamin Harrison. And the winner of that the Electoral College vote was Benjamin Harrison. But the winner of the popular vote was Grover Cleveland. Now, how did Cleveland pull that off, and why is it fair what happened? Can you think of a reason why it might be fair? A fair thing, that a good thing, that Grover Cleveland didn't win that seat and that Benjamin Harrison did.
Well, you know what? First of all, I don't ever use the term fair because it's
okay,
either
yeah.
just or unjust.
I got
and
you.
I'm not cutting you off on that. But
no, I agree.
But the whole point is that honestly, I'm not sure. What would be the case?
Well, you have to think of it think in terms of party politics and post-Civil War feeling. Because remember, a lot of people vote emotionally when they shouldn't for president.
We have that happen all the time now.
Yeah, well, I'd say 2008 is a fine example of that. But
and 2004 and 2000, and I can go back.
Yeah,
and
we can go.
I'm,
yeah,
my personal viewpoint is, and yeah, you know, I can share it with myself, or I'll share it with the world here now, is that apathy wins most elections.
Yeah, well, absolutely,
because most people just don't care, and they
That's
go
right.
by. Well, this guy's my party, or I like that guy's name, or you know, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They don't go look at the candidates for the content of what they believe.
And by the way, this is one of the reasons that the Founding Fathers eschewed universal suffrage, because they wanted people who were thinking to be involved in the voting process. And they figured that there were certain criteria they would set up, and they weren't perfect people, and they had some rather odd prejudices of their own. But that doesn't say you throw the baby out with the bathwater. Universal suffrage has always proven to be a rather bad idea, and Frederick Bastiat is a great person to read in the law to find out why. We won't go into that today. But let's go back to the election of 1888,
mm-hmm.
Keep back on topic. In 1888, again, with the really heavy bad feeling for the North and for the Republican Party in the South, Grover Cleveland was running as a Democrat. Benjamin Harrison was running as a Republican. Well, you couldn't get elected drain commissioner in the South as a Republican for about 100 years after the Civil War.
Okay.
All right. Now, what happened in the South with Grover Cleveland? Well, Grover Cleveland was pulling essentially 67%, 70%, 75% of the popular vote in the South.
Okay.
So the Solid South essentially went for Grover Cleveland in a big, big, big way.
Sure.
In the North, Grover Cleveland lost by tiny margins, 51.1 to 49.9, 50.5 to 49.5, those kind of things. So Grover Cleveland lost the election in the North by tiny margins. In other words, people sort of liked him, but not well enough. They liked Benjamin Harrison a little bit better. So what happened was this gigantic Southern vote comes in, popular vote, but they don't have that. It's a small population electorally. So the North, basically by small margins, gives their electoral votes to Benjamin Harrison.
So this was in a winner. They had a winner take all system.
Some of the systems, yeah. This is 1888. A lot of the systems had converted to winner take all.
Okay.
And so what happens is Grover Cleveland wins big in the popular vote, but he loses by a small margin in the Electoral College.
Uh huh.
And Grover Cleveland thought it was a fair decision. I mean, he did not, you know, he didn't play hanging chads, and we need congressional hearings. Now, there are other elections where there were tie votes in the electoral that turned into a complete mess, and it's such an incredible mess that we're not even going to go into it because it was so extra-constitutional that it's not even worth mentioning. That's the election of 1876, commonly called the stolen election. And, if popular votes always ought to win, then Samuel J. Tilden and Albert Gore Jr. ought to be, we should know them as presidents of the United States, and we don't. And there's good reason for that.
I'm sure at least in one of those people's minds, they still think of themselves as president of the United States.
I think Albert Gore Jr. still thinks he got elected. Samuel Tilden accepted, he didn't like it, but he accepted the decision of, now he was not... Truly, if you want to see a selected, not elected, that would be the Tilden race where I'm trying to remember who won that race. It would have been...
Wasn't Tilden.
No, it was Rutherford B. Hayes. Another one of our Ohio guys. Rutherford B. Hayes, and he accepted that. That's when you get in and examine some of these oddball tie votes. Electoral ties and also popular, you know, where the popular vote looks so overwhelming, you have to get down and examine them a little more closely. You know, just say, well, he won the popular vote, and therefore he should be that. That is a democratic ideal. That is not an ideal of liberty, because if regions can band together and overwhelm the rest of the country, then basically what you've got is regions who run the country. That's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing. And folks, if you think that our electoral system now is in bad shape, if we keep moving in the direction that the innovators want to take us, what we're going to end up with is we don't have states anymore. We'll have administrative regions. And each of those regions will then be vying with each other over who controls the country.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because if I'm not mistaken, next week we're discussing... the possibility of a constitutional convention, and we will discuss some of the models that include the elimination of states and the going to a direct popular referendum on things like the presidency. And the states are eliminated and are replaced with administrative regions.
Yeah, that wasn't my own original idea. I have read that somewhere before.
Yeah.
But ladies and gentlemen, see, these are the type of things that we need to make sure that people who are patriotic Americans, who love their country, who love the Constitution, who want to see us stand on our bedrock principles, and who are concerned about the direction we're going, we have to have it grounded in a firm foundation, that the firmest of foundations, which is God's word. And then the document that was based from that, if you look at our founders and their philosophies, they drew much of their wisdom for how they put together our Constitution from God's word, specifically from the book of Deuteronomy and from the writings of St. Paul. It was the source most quoted by the founders in all of their writings in relation to government. So we have to get back to those things. Now, these are the things we teach you when we teach Institute on the Constitution. If you go to our website at principledpolicy.com or at campamerican.com, you can find out more about these Institute on the Constitution courses, where we're holding them, how you can sign up, so that you can get a deeper appreciation and understanding for how this document works, how our founders' genius led to structures that still today have great use and effect, if only we would get back to them. This discussion on the Electoral College today is just a part of what we do over 12 weeks with that course. So we would encourage that. And as we're running out of time today, we want to thank you for being here with us. And we ask you to tune in weekdays at 5:30 for our 15-minute update program. And again, every Saturday at noon here on WLRY as you listen to Principles and Policies.
Next week, we'll discuss the possibility of a new constitutional convention.